You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Van Morrison.
Don't want to discuss it. Make it time for a change.
You make
it disgusting.
Yeah, the All Marine Radio head chef saw him in San Francisco fall off a stage drunk. They sobered his ass up. Said, hey, there's people that paid. Get out there. Do something. I'm too drunk. We don't care. Puke and get your ass out there. All right. Associated Press is reporting U.S. intelligence boss tells the Associated Press that the security clearance system is broken amid questions over White House aides' access. So how does a guy who comes up on the FBI's radar, and again, now here's the problem, and I referenced this when I made my comments about John Kelly, and I'll do that. I don't know if I'll have time to do it today. But again, Mike Musselman and I were talking about John Kelly, and you know what? The world of politics is sick, and Mike was talking about how frustrated he gets when people they try to tell you you're things you're not, and that's what's happened to John Kelly. You know, in two separate instances, he gets asked about, you know, why 1.8 million instead of 700,000 or whatever the DACA registrars are, people who register. He said, well, you know, there's some people that didn't register because they might have been intimidated. Some of them might have been lazy. And, so he says that. So now we're going to play that he said he's calling Hispanics. Now we're going to play the lazy Mexican card. Okay. First of all, anybody that knows anything about Mexicans and the Hispanic culture, yeah, lazy, not a word that is normally associated with them. They work, okay? Second of all, the 1st Marine Division junior enlisted members are comprised predominantly of Marines from the western part of the United States. Those states, predominantly California, Arizona, Texas, make up a lot of the 1st Marine Division. How about the demographics of that? Yeah. Heavily Hispanic. Disproportionate. Okay? And so when you go fight as a member of the 1st Marine Division, yeah, you habla. Not that you need to, but. And let me tell you, and they fight, and they're incredible fighters. And so there's an egalitarian egalitarianism in combat, in death, in getting wounded, in tragedy, in valor. And you learn that it comes in every color, comes in both sexes, comes in every religion, right? The common denominator for us, that title, Marine. So if people that sell that shit ought to be embarrassed. But they are part of the sick political system that is ruining this country. And maybe it's always been part of this country. And now, you know, as I'm older, I just see it on a more regular basis, and it nauseates me. But you want to lay that on John Kelly? You know, you should go to hell. Okay? You should go to hell. Ask that to all the different families of all the different people of every color that guy's reached out to, being a Gold Star father, being a general officer, being a commanding officer. He doesn't distinguish color. And I know that. I've worked with him in peacetime. I've worked with him in wartime. I consider him a personal friend. He, Karen, his son John, daughter Kathleen. But again, I'm not saying this because I'm friends with him. I'm saying this because I know it to be true. If it wasn't true, I wouldn't say shit. And it's disgusting to watch this. So now, when you see a guy like John Kelly, after this accusation is made against Porter, right, and he comes out and says he's an honorable man, you know, with integrity, what's wrong there? You're going to sell me somebody who's had two nephews shot in the head in domestic violence. You're going to sell me that John Kelly knew the allegations, had seen those pictures, and came out and said that. Okay, I'm going to give you some life advice. When something happens and somebody that you know has great credibility says something that judged by subsequent events, you is a head scratcher, then there's something going on there that you don't know about. Either he didn't have access to that information, or there was an allegation of it. This guy said it didn't happen. I didn't do that. I'm innocent. And that's what you know? And so what do? If that's what you know, you judge him based on what you know. So again, my life experience, and this is what I'm going to give you. When you see something, quality person, something you don't understand, then there's either you don't know that person very well, or something happened in there that you don't know that they're not talking about. Right? And so this bullshit with John Kelly is just political, disgusting stuff. And Gunner's going to come on and talk about, he wrote a really long Facebook post yesterday. I saw it, I went, uh-oh. trying to be honest and truthful and forthcoming with people that aren't interested in that. Right? And as I said earlier, that's why, given the opportunity, Mac, you can run for re-election or you can go to Afghanistan. What are you doing? I'll go to Afghanistan. It's easier there. It's easier. All right, so combat concepts, part one. Tony Zinni. Here you go. Okay, this is 1989 in the summer. General Van Riper's the head man. General Van Riper's the head man at Marine Corps University. He brings Colonel Zinni, who just left 9th Marines, where Van Riper had been the chief of staff there before he went to McSittick as a brigadier general. So, and they're all buddies, right? So Van Riper, Zinni, they're all Vietnam, you know, guys together. So, also there that night is John Ripley, John Boyd, United States Air Force, father of the OOD loop, that guy, he's in the audience. Major John Kelly, Captain Lou Caporata, I'm there. Lou is the, CG of 1MEF now. So there's all kinds of, but we're captains. Kelly's major. Also in the audience, Colonel Mike Wiley, who was over at Marine Corps University as well. He was kind of like this intellectual sage, but he talked funny. So people didn't know, you know, the first thing to do was ridicule him. I'm Mike Wiley. And he's talked like that. So anyway, still does. And then Bill Lind, who's been this critical, you know, thing in the Marine Corps for a long time, talking about maneuver warfare. And, but he's never been in the military, which is always interesting to talk to him. So this is an audience and it's at, in the dining facility at the basic school, which was a huge room. And so Zinni, and the room is full. The room is full. I went because I saw Kelly. I'd never heard of Zinni in my life. And Kelly sees me the day of, in the morning. I don't know, I was going out to a problem or something like that. He says, Mac, you going to go see Colonel Zinni tonight? I said, I don't know who he is. There's always some jackass speaking at the basic school. Should I go? And he said, don't miss it. Got it. And so I went. Okay. Greatest PME I've ever been to. But that's the setting for this.
What I'd like to do, though, is not being the lecturer up here and just give you another jump on another way of looking at the same kinds of things we talked about, but maybe be the catalyst for discussion. There are times here when we've really gotten into the give and take, and I'd like to invite that, and more than happy that this pitch could be used as a means of doing that. Now, first let me explain what this pitch is. In the 9th Marine Regiment, where I just came from, I give this pitch to all the battalions when they first come in. I want to explain a little bit about the officer school out there because it's necessary, I think, for you to understand some of this. Our officer school is pretty expensive, and there's a couple reasons why it can be. We're not encumbered by dependents out there, which is a good thing. I try to run the officer school in a series of different kinds of events. On Friday afternoons, we do the theory or the math exercise, which lasts a good all whole afternoon and usually into the happy hour of the band and the cruise in Kingville. On Wednesday evenings, we do what we call battlefield skills. The lieutenants got on me and said, the theory and the math exercise are great, kind of the things that we've been doing in here, the sand tables and everything else, but we want some of the techniques too. So that's where I teach scouting and patrolling, where we teach takedown of a building, that sort of thing. We also have Warriors Night, where we bring people from outside to talk to the officers about certain things. We had Mike Wiley and General Van Riper talking about maneuver warfare. We've had them on special operations, Mount, you know, with General Christmas and General Johnson, and those sorts of things. The officer school program is pretty involved, and we use that as a way of maybe teaching the concepts of maneuver warfare too, in a lot of different areas. I give about 95 to 98% of all the officers first. Now there's a reason for all that, the reason why I'm telling you this. One of the things we're dealing with is commander's intent here. We had a big discussion about that. My feeling, what I tell all lieutenants when the units first come in, is someday that lieutenant might find himself on top of a hill with his platoon, you know, that we are somewhere doing something for real, or maybe on an exercise and not for real, but as things normally happen, he can't talk to anybody, but he knows he's got to do something. Now, at that point in time, he's got to ask himself, what would Colonel Vinny expect me to do right now? And I want him to have a clue. So commander's intent begins when he first arrives in my regiment. I begin explaining to him how I think, how I feel things go down. This class is my idea, my conceptualization of the battlefield and fighting and what it's all about. I also tell him that when we're at officer school, he has the right to challenge anything I say. As a matter of fact, I wrote a letter to all my officers. It's the lead into the first map exercise that says, my solutions, my statements, my concepts should be under the most serious challenge. And they have to stand up and question and challenge it. Don't accept anything that I say. And they take me up on that. There are a lot of, there's some officers in here that have been through that, Lieutenant Brown and a few others that were out there in the battalions that came through. And I'll tell you, they'll stick it through you in a heartbeat because the Mike Wiley's the world, everybody else, made little mavericks out of these guys. And they come out of there and they're running for it, you know. And I got to tell you the truth, and I'd be lying, they've sent me back to Blackboard many times. I've had to change my slides, scratch my ideas, and hope the next battalion didn't realize that some lieutenant taught me that myself, you know. But then you got to be that way. You got to accept and learn. Now, I'm not going to give you the pitch.
Now, how funny is that? This guy's a regimental commander. How many of us have ever heard a pitch like this? This is what you got when you went to 9th Marines. You got him telling you this is the gospel according to Zinni. Thought out, reasoned, rationale. You could argue with them. We don't do enough of this shit. Company commanders ought to do it too. Battalion commanders ought to do it. Every leader ought to get down and say, this is how I see it.
Exactly the way I give it there. I'm going to give you the concepts and things and the statements I make, but then I'd like you to draw examples from experiences out there to bring them out to you. One unusual thing about out there I think worth talking about. I mentioned today that 15 battalions came under the 9th Marines control while I was out there in 2 years in the DT program. I also had another 4 infantry battalions operational control under me in exercises for 10 days to a month. You know, so that's a total of 19 battalions, infantry. I've also had armored assault LAI for another 2, and I've had 2 different battalions artillery in direct support. From every single infantry regiment in the Marine Corps, I've had battalions. So if you want to know a guy that can tell you what the Marine Corps is about, or the battalions, at least one perspective, if you want a judgment on Lejeune versus Pendleton versus K-Day, I can give it to you, you know? And if you want a comparison of what they're coming with or without, I think I can give it to you. The experiences are based on 10 major exercises or deployments, and a shit pot full of observations, training, and things that were done on Okinawa or short-term off of that. They were MUSOC, they were the regiment as part of the division, they were as an RLT as part of the brigade. You know, so it's a variety of experiences, too. Combat concepts are my thoughts of 24 years' experience about combat. And I got to tell you, the first thing that struck me as the regimental commander when I got there is I need to take the previous experience that I've had in Vietnam, in my course of time in the Marine Corps, in what I've read, and I've got to distill this and decide what I think.
Okay, now just so you know, first tour in Vietnam as an advisor, he'll talk about that, but just as a frame of reference. Second one is as a company commander, he'll talk about that. So as a regimental commander, that's what he's doing.
And at least have a starting point. Lay these concepts out, and then make sure it's dynamic. You're willing to change, you're willing to accept the criticism of somebody teaching me something. This little thing has changed probably 50 times in 2 years that I've given. And I think it's important for a commander to come to grips with his own feelings and his own understandings and lay it out in front of his officers and staff NCOs. I didn't even get into the staff NCO education program we have and the NCO program, and this is part of it too. But the idea is that I've got to expose my thoughts. It's the beginning of understanding each other, familiarity, commander's intent. I've got to tell you another side of this thing before I launch into it. The chief of staff when I first got there was Colonel von Reichert. Now, I want to tell you, when I walked in, and I got some strict marching orders from the chief. The chief told me that it's not enough to talk about maneuver warfare. And you can have all the classes you want up there, Zinni, and all the little math exercises you want, and that doesn't impress me worth a shit, because everybody's doing that. He said, what our task is going to be in 3rd Marine Division is we are going to apply this. And we're going to learn the lessons of trying to put it into practice from the squad level to the division level. And we're going to make it work or find out why not. So that was my chart. And we'd get together every once in a while and talk about where we screwed up or where I screwed up, even what we talked about. And the lessons learned and the trouble we were running into and the success. I got to tell you another thing. Inside the classroom, There's no one out there, Lieutenant Colonel below, that's not accepting this. I mean, there are a lot of people that understand it in varying degrees that don't understand it to a certain degree. They accept the maneuver warfare doctrine. They're happy about it. But I found that within the classroom, it all was good. It was accepted. It was fine. And I felt really warm and fuzzy when I go out to observe training. We do an exercise in business as usual. None of this manifested itself in an application in training, in day-to-day life, in the exercises that we did, the deployments, and a couple of real contingencies that we kind of almost got into out there, too.
Okay, now, I'm going to be critical of General Van Riper. He called him Von Riper. I didn't understand him, okay? And that's his fault. And it was my loss, honestly, professionally, because... First of all, Van Riper, right, is a tall, lean, kind of wiry build guy with his shaved head and glasses. Okay, looks every bit the part of an egghead. Okay, and when you say, you know, and he was a stern guy. He had a reputation for maniacal discipline, right? He'd hop out of a vehicle if he was going someplace and he saw Marines humping, and he'd stop them. Hey, what's in your left your little cargo pockets on the back of your pack? They're supposed to be on the left. There were supposed to be sandbags in the center. There's supposed to be socks and powder on the right. There was supposed to be your rubber jacket or something. It was all laid out. There was division SOP. That's discipline, okay? There's a reason we do that. But it was all lost. It wasn't communicated, right? And so what Zinni's doing as an evangelist is he's hanging meat on these rules so you get the buy-in that Van Riper never got. Now, I'm working on a kind of history of maneuver warfare, and hopefully General Gray is going to be the first guest we're going to do, and we'll get General Van Riper as well. But I didn't see that. And now what do we talk about on the program law? Discipline, structure that the organization has to have, right? Because when you go, you're not going to get it on the plane over there. You're going to get your ass kicked. People are going to get killed. And I missed that. But it's Van Riper's fault, not mine.
So by God, I had to take General Van Riper and then Colonel Van Riper's tasking the heart and try to apply this. I want to bring out some of the lessons learned. Now let me make the first point here. The first slide I always lead off with in capital letters is this: the commander in combat. before I get into anything else, because you see, we depersonalize what this is all about. We're process-oriented, as come out here in the last couple of days. I think if I had to describe our system, what we would say, if again that Martian came down and visited the Marine Corps, is you built yourself a process. You built yourself a bunch of checklists and a system, and what you're telling me is personalities don't count, people don't count. Just take the guy and kind of put him through some rudimentary training, processing through the schools, plug him in, and the system will take care of him. The staff will take care of him, the planning process will take care of him. Well, it doesn't work. It doesn't happen that way. The most important component of command is the commander. The commander has got to have a personality, he's got to have a style, he's got to have an innovative, fresh thought once in a while, he's got to drive things. You know, he can't just be another guy in the system, in the organization. And so I always spend the first part of this pitch talking about the commander. There are two people on that battlefield.
Now think about this. Think how many commanders you have and how many stood up and did some shit like this. This ought to be required. There's an article in the Gazette in that little argument, and I had to write it too. Listen to this and tell me if you're a battalion commander, if you're a company commander, if you're a regimental division commander, why haven't you done this? They need, how can you do intent when they don't even fucking know you? They don't know how to think. They don't know how you think. Hey, when in doubt, go on the offensive. We always go on the offensive, unless you simply can't. You know, whatever your philosophy is, you need to get out there and speak to them.
Either the commander or the leader who supports the commander. Now, my officer schools require everybody attends. The chaplain, the doctor, the motor T officer, the supply officer, everybody. And we only talk in officer school about warfighting. There's no such thing as, you know, we're going to cover how to read the less today or any of that other bullshit. No, we talk about warfighting only. And it's important to not write yourself off because you're not the commander. I told some of you, and I got a class on the chaplain in combat. It's a very important class. Matter of fact, the chaplain, the division psychiatrist, gave one of the best officer schools we had on handling combat stress and returning the guy to the front line and where the chaplain ought to be located during combat. And it was pretty valuable. It was very important. Generated maybe more discussion than any other officer school I ever heard. And read about some of the battles of World War II and look at how many people we lost to battle fatigue. And you can see that's a tremendous drain. This guy has a lot to offer, both of them, if they're motivated properly and want to do that. Now, I tell my guys that what they've got to do is basically four things. One is understand the battlefield. Second, be able to sense the battlefield. Three, be able to take the battlefield and finally be able to fight the battle. It's this simple. This is what you as a commander or a leader supports the commander has got to master. Now, how do you understand the battlefield? Well, part of it is what we are doing today. It's part of what schools do here. It's trying to distill from our study, our readings, previous wars, from reality what the battlefield is all about. It's more to it than that. I mean, reading's great. I like reading. There's three things I know for sure that reading won't get you there totally on. You know, it's how to fight, you know, it's how to cook, and it's how to make love. And you get some great ideas out of books. But still, you got to do some of this stuff once in a while to really get good at it, you know? And that's what I tell my guys, they can appreciate that. Now, we go to the field, all right? And we go on...
How funny is that shit?
...an exercise. How closely do we simulate combat? In some areas, we do pretty well. In some areas, we simulate things very well. In some areas, we don't approximize combat, but we do something pretty close. In other words, we certainly create enough friction ourselves to have friction present. It isn't the same kind of friction, but there is a friction. You know, we almost get inside our own OODA loops and unravel ourselves. But you know, it's a sense of understanding what the battlefield, what friction is about. Things are screwed up. Every after action, every hot wash up, everybody's bitching about comp. Calm wasn't good enough. Calm is never good enough. I got a rule in my dreams to shut down two-thirds of the next. My commos love that shit, see, because there's no pressure on it. You know? I don't like to see little charts with arrows going up, sideways, down. Screw that shit. Give me at least one VHF, UHF, HF. That I'm happy. You know? Two-thirds of the nets are shut down. We randomly take the nets and close them down to see if we can operate with one-third of the nets. The last meth exercise that I went on, you know what the requirement of the meth was, the radio net? 412 nets. Can you imagine that? 412 nests, you know, emitting all in the same grid square. I mean, it's no way. I don't want to turn big on.
He's hilarious, man. Yeah, now think about it with a near peer. Not the permissive environments that we fought in, but a near peer that can, that when you light that electromagnetic signature off, you know, all of a sudden it comes raining down 400 and some on for the meth. Oh my God.
Communications is not common. I'm going to talk about common. The other part of understanding the battlefield here too, though, is sometimes we trick ourselves. We think we understand about the battlefield, and we don't. We take something in training that presents itself and assume it's reality. I had two tragic experiences out there, two helicopter crashes, one that cost me 30 Marines and another one that cost me 14 Marines, you know, out of two of my battalions. I was there for both of them. On one, I was in the zone when they were picked up. I spent the day with that company when that bird went down. On the second one, I was on the ship on the bridge when it went into the water. Now, let me tell you something. These were in the middle of an exercise. These are Marines that were caught up in a very realistic exercise. One a USOC exercise, one a force-on-force in Korea with everything. I mean, it was in the middle of Team Spirit, the largest exercise we do, so we had everything. So, I mean,
my battalion, the deployment before I got there. 53 flew into the side of a mountain in the fog.
There were airplanes, tanks, cracked, so they were caught up. Real villagers and the troops were into it. Real aggressors that are working against it. That particular company, for example, had just finished a masterful ambush. What we had done is we had laid my CP as base, which I really love, but actually my command group out in the middle of this little grove of trees. We were convinced the bad guys would see it. The other guys had a little used sock outfit, the one that floats around out there, and we knew they'd do something against us. So we laid in an ambush with that company. We hid the troops around the paddy dikes, and we put the heavy machine guns in Hummers in the tree lines with some LAIs, LAVs. When the helicopters came in for the big assault raid on the CK, they go, whack, they ran out. This company was euphoric. I mean, they were on a high. They were great. When that tragedy hit, when that one platoon was wiped out and 30 men died, that company was just devastated. That battalion was devastated. Now, for the first time, they experienced a real feeling that would happen in war. We were playing cowboys and Indians, bang, bang. We were assessing casualties. People were being medevaced out with pretend wounds with moulage kits. These were real dead people that you had to dig out of a burning helicopter. And they experienced, for the first time, and hopefully the only time in peacetime of training, the real feeling of a loss and dead buddies and everything else.
You know, it's interesting because before you do go to war, you don't know. I mean, you hear him talking, and to have that kind of loss in peacetime, what do we do? Do we stop? And I had this in my head because I'd heard it so many times. And then you experience in combat, there, you can't stop. You got to get those bodies out of here, and we got to go. And, you know, I mean, this is why this shit is should be required.
That's something you can't simulate. Now, my obligation as a battalion commander was to get their head back in the game and force them to go right back into the exercise, which in both cases we did. And there were some questions about that. Some troops saying, should we continue on or shouldn't we? Should we get back into the helicopter? You know, obviously the leader's got to be the first ones in and you got to show them. But that's an element of the battlefield and understanding it that you can't ever simulate anywhere. Those troops will never forget that. Those of us who were in Vietnam, we lived that. Now, let me tell you another part of understanding this battlefield that they want from me. I got to be honest with you. This is one I don't feel good about. They're always hitting me up for your combat experiences in Vietnam. I had two tours in Vietnam. One as an advisor to the Vietnamese Marine, one as a regular company commander. They want to always tap you for what was it like. There's a temptation to take the experiences you had and draw too much out of it. And you got to be careful of that. We have, our memory does a trick on us. I remember things differently than they maybe really were. Maybe better than they were. Maybe I remember lessons that weren't really there. Maybe I remember doing things in a very orderly fashion that led to some results that weren't done in an orderly fashion. It didn't quite lead to that result that I made up. So I got to constantly do a self-test, and I'm a little reluctant to tap the combat experience and explain it. But it's necessary. I try to bring in the guys like Phil Fight, John Ripley, General Van Riper, all the people that were out there, Mike Wiley, that did have combat experience. One of the best nights we had was on combat leadership. And that was the night when I had General Van Riper, I had Colonel Ripley, John Ripley, and I had Colonel Bill Fight. Highly decorated, great combat experience, very credible men, and I put them in front of the officers and it was go for it, question and answer. An interesting thing happened. They asked these guys a question, and the three guys answered it in a different way. This blew their vacuum tubes. And they couldn't understand how three guys with a 6-5 full of Navy Cross, Silver Stars, all these things, great guys, senior officers, came to different conclusions on the same experiences. And they started asking me, which one do you agree with? I hate to say this, guys, get in trouble. They called one the Prussian, who I won't name. And one the surfer. And you can sort out who they are. Don't wax the board, General. You're right.
So Van Riper's sitting off to the side, right? And he's an intimidating guy. And Zinni's not. I mean, Zinni's, you know, he's approachable. And one's a Prussian, one's a philosopher, and one's a surfer, right? Everybody laughing. And then he looks right at Van Riper and he says, "Don't wax your board, General." Oh, my God. It was hilarious.
But the lieutenants feel from these people were interesting in their approaches to the same thing. Things like flak jackets and helmets. I'm an anti-flak jacket helmet guy. I don't believe in them. I hate them. I don't think you ever need them. We ought to sit down for a lot of reasons. I'll talk about later. They serve no purpose, you know. For everyone a guy can say, they just saved my life. There's 87 guys running around that were so tired, pooped out, worn out, that they didn't see the bad guy, got caught in an ambush, you know, the troops were trained. And they don't serve that kind of purpose. It's counter to mobility and everything else. Well, we got that was just one thing that generated a real heated discussion amongst those officers and amongst the group. Because there were some of them that said, "You wear them all the time. Mine was zipped. My tin strap was always fucking bullshit." I've never seen a tin strap buckle in any Vietnam picture I've ever seen in my life. But that's a little off the point. It's a little bit trying to understand what goes on in the back.
He's awesome, isn't he? You know, and again, that was a huge argument in the Marine Corps, flak jackets and helmets. You know, every picture you see in Vietnam, you see guys in bush covers, you see guys moving, it's hot. You know, and now we got flak jackets and helmets everywhere we go. And then he becomes the burning bush for me. Who is this guy? So smart, combat experience, common sense, the ability to relate it to different people. And then to play the range of characters to be able to relate to lieutenants, to be able to relate to senior officers, staff NCOs, junior enlisted, and they're all different populations. And he, right, he's a chameleon in terms of his ability to be an evangelist. I mean, this little pitch is a choreographed ambush of these officers. He knows his audience, and he's going to crush them.
Sensing the battlefield. What I tell my guys is, you know, whether we're, I first heard this term finger licking here that we're talking about.
Okay, so the term, it's sensing the battlefield. I can't remember the German, hold on, let me look it up real quick. German term, sensing the battlefield. So we got guys like Bill Lind, Fingerspitzenfuhl. That's what it's called. So, and then Zinni. So Linda's sitting there, who's constantly jamming it up the Marine Corps' ass and telling the Marine Corps, "You're all fools. You need to get your heads out of your ass." And he, you know, and he had valid points, no doubt, no doubt. And Zinni rolls up there, and Lynn's sitting there, and he looks right at him. He says, "I first heard this term," and he flicks his left arm towards Lynn, finger licking, or right, and he likens it to Kentucky Fried Chicken, and you can tell his audience loves it. And then he goes into the concept and why it's so important. So he's
whatever this is, which is probably the basic instincts you got to develop about the battlefield, about war. This is you got to learn how to sense what's going on in the battlefield. You got to prepare yourself for how to sense it. I'm going to give you a couple examples. The only guy I ever met in my life that had a natural feel for this shit was Ray Smith. He was my XO when I was battalion commander, Ray Cole said. And Smith was uncanny. It just pissed me off because I had to work hard to try to figure shit out that came naturally to him. The scariest thing that ever happened to me in the middle of the cast, we had two engineer breaching teams to breach the wire to go into the bunker complex. And we had talked about, you know, this little lieutenant who had a genius idea. She says, "Sir, I'm going to create out of high a third breaching team in case one goes wrong." And I thought it was a little unnecessary, but he did. Smart kid. One did not go. You know, one of those little Bangalore suckers did not go boom. And I was stuck with one company breaching going in, one hung up. The other breaching team was back with red. And one boom went. The other one didn't go right away, and I was in the track, and I was about to squeeze the handset to say, "Send up the breaching team," and over this thing came Ray Smith and said, "I know you want the breaching team." I dropped the handset, and I got a little scared, but he used to do this shit to me all the time. But what I also tell my guys is the number of battles take place out there. The real battle is what the company commander and the platoon commander see. That's the real battle. As you start moving back to battalion and regiment and everything else, a different battle takes place. The battle that goes on inside my COC can be an entirely different fight than really taking place. If I don't have a means of truly sensing the reality of the battle, as close as I can get it, I'm going to be experiencing a different fight back in my CP, you know, back it with my command group, no matter where it is. I'm going to talk a little bit about command and control later and how you set yourself up to sense the battlefield. Not how you set yourself up, how I set myself up, whether you want to use it or believe it or not. But it's the way I have to do it to sense reality as much as possible. Understanding how to... I used to say see the battlefield here, because I think that's the term the Army uses in one of their manuals. But I got rid of see. I like sense, because I want to get away from ever thinking that it's just physically using your eyes or physically using reconnaissance or intelligence collection anyway. There is a sixth sense involved here, an instinct that you develop, and there's a way that, I want to use one of Colonel Boyd's terms, that you synthesize all these things and you draw conclusions and they come together. And that total sensing is important. The next one is shaping the battlefield. Now, if you talk to most officers about how you shape the battlefield, they would say it's battlefield geometry to come down to that. You know, they physically get down on their maps, and there's a lot of little geometry that goes onto these maps, and all kinds of control measures. Exhaustive 3 comes up and says, "Their kernel is the battlefield, in black and blue ink. You can't even read the goddamn grid lines anymore on these maps." Now, I never looked at the 3's map. I never even looked at the 3, which pisses me off. Without talking, I don't look at it. I always look at the 2's map. It's the only thing I focus on visually, as far as sensing the battlefield. Never the 3's map. I'm not interested in the 3. That's the way you'd like the world to be. That's not the way the world is. Some people think they shape the battlefield by a plan. A plan gets you started. You need a plan to kind of get to the line of departure, to get to the starting gate through it. But after that, the plan's not worth much. It's just something to brag off of, you know, to be the basis of everything that got you there. I got a little phrase I tell all my guys, don't fall in love with your plan. And I constantly have to screw it, because the little suckers behind my back will produce the 8-pound top order. And so the first thing you got to do when you get to the field is change everything. As soon as they come in and they unroll the overlay and do all this shit, I change everything. My proudest moment as a regimental commander was on a tremendous rainy night, you know, when it was probably the most miserable night of my life, on a hill in Korea, stuck in the back of a Humvee, and the watch officer, this little captain, my S3 out, was sitting there, and it was time to issue a frag, and I told him what we were going to do, and he pumped out a quick yellow canary, and he took his big gigantic crayon, and he whipped out an overlay in about a nanosecond, which just basically was your basic fundamental nothing overlay. And he looked at that and he said, "You know, Colonel, I used to pride myself on my overlays until I started working for you." And he said, "I never would put any effort into these things anymore now, because I know what you're doing." I said, "Yeah, you arrived, I understand. Matter of fact, you don't need that thing. Get rid of it." So it's important not to get hung up on all that. And of course, the key one is the actual execution and fighting of the battle day to day, minute to minute. Now, I want to take you back a little bit. I want to start somewhere. Back with Lieutenant Finney. Lieutenant Finney reported to this fine institution in 1965. A dirt ball straight off the streets of Philadelphia. Okay? My father was a corporal in World War I, third grade education. My brother was a sergeant in Korea. I never knew another officer in my entire life. You know? I joined the Marine Corps by accident, went through PLC program, got through, got commissioned. The MOI at Villanova was shocked to even see me, didn't know I existed. People that, like Bass Hurst, who was one of the platoon sergeants down there, would have been surprised to find out they actually put bars on. I showed up here at basic school. Nothing was happening in the world. Nice set of dress blues, good paycheck. I was happy. Mary Washington was south. Bush, Neal, and I go up north to Washington, D.C. Life was good. Somewhere shortly after we got out of here, we got here, these little bastards decided to go into Vietnam with the Marine Brigade, and General Van Riper was down in Santo Domingo doing some shit. So we all got told, as these basic school instructors will, you suckers are all going to die. We're at war now, you know? It became time to pay attention. And I figured, hey, I was going to be an infantry recruit. There was no one-third, one-third kit, you know, because I was at the bottom of the pit, and I was going to be an infantry. That's what they threatened me with, and they were going to fulfill that prophecy, and I was going to be an infantry.
Can you hear people laughing? It's hilarious. And all he's doing is setting the hook deeper. But it gets funnier as he goes. But talking about the way we produce people and the effect of that and how we look at the battlefield. You know, his whole thing. I don't look at the threes map. I don't even look at the three, which pisses him off. That's the way the world you want. That's the world the way you want it to be, not the way the world is. The way the world is a twos map. Right? Don't bother me with the blue shit. Show me the red shit. And so, I mean, hearing this again, 1989, and again, I want you to think about it. How many times have you heard a regimental commander do this? And the answer is, hardly ever. And we got to get better at that.
So now I decided it's time for me, if I'm smart, I long talked with myself in a third wing over top deck. You might go somewhere and actually get shot at me. It's a good idea if you figure some of this shit out. And I said, now I looked around at these guys, the pictures on the wall, they're going to tell me what to do. Lo and behold, that week, I was going to be queen for a day. I was going to be the squad leader on BO3, whatever, squad on the golf course out here, you know? That beautiful rolling piece of cut grass and everything, range 5 or whatever it is.
Okay, it is range 5. He remembers it perfectly. Let me describe range 5. It's a rectangle. Cut out of the woods, right? At the bottom of the rectangle near your chest is a where there's a tree line, and then the cut begins. It slopes up to a little hill, and then from that hill, it's like a golf course. It goes straight down, and then it goes up to another small hill, okay? So, and there might be about 300, 400 meters difference between the two hills. Maybe 200. Okay? And it's probably a couple hundred meters, and it might be 100 meters wide, this rectangle. Okay? And so you put them in an assembly area before the attack in the trees, like right near your chest, and then you go down, and then in this range, there's holes in the ground with barbed wire around it, and in those there's quarter sticks of dynamite, which are always fun. We used to try to pop them when our friends would walk by. Our friends would be yelling at somebody, get out, or move, come on, or suppress that target, right? And not paying attention, they'd wind up right next to a demo bed. Quarter stick of TNT going off on their ass, and they just turn and look at the tower when we'd wave, hey, what's up? Pay attention. Come on, this is combat. And so Marine Corps has been doing this forever. It's where you learn how to close with the enemy, without any vegetation that makes it more difficult. Okay, so it's infantry movement 101, and then you do it without any ammunition, dry runs, and then you do we give them ammunition. As targets have gotten better, the targets get automated, they pop up and they get knocked down. Blah 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 blah. So that's what Zinni's going to talk about right here. Range 5, a hallmark for Marine officers.
And I said, pay attention because this is the way war is. So when I got out there with my little squad, they took me up to this area and had a little red sign. Yellow stenciling, red sign said assembly area. Nice little grove of trees back there. And they explained to me the characteristics. This sucker is out of direct fire, observation of the enemy, This is where he's trying to get your shit together, issue the order, get your ammo, all your shit, make sure you keep busy, because the little guy in the skunk hat will kill you if you don't. And you get here to issue your order.
Okay, the guy in the skunk hat is the evaluator. He had a one of those, an old steel pot with a stripe on it, so a stripe around the base of it, so you would know he was an instructor, so you wouldn't yell at him.
Prepare to go into the attack. I had read that you better conduct the reconnaissance. So I go up to the guy in the skunk hat, excuse me, I'd like to go forward to the line of departure and conduct my reconnaissance. Okay, good, Vinny, another check mark, 5 points for Vinny, and I crawl up to the line of departure. Nice little berm that they had cut there. Crawled up, peeked over. There, out there, were all the things I expected to see. Wrote my little notes, got back, issued my order. Little sign up there that said LD. The big argument here in those days was whether that should be LOD or LD. We were in the heady shit. And I didn't want to get Tom Adams, it was over my head.
That might be one of the funniest things of the whole thing, right? So the Marine Corps at the time is having this huge argument about maneuver warfare. You know, there was two camps, right? An attritionist, which was the old two up, one back crew, or one up and two back, and then maneuver warfare people who were trying to study the Germans and the whole concept of the Blitzkrieg. What was it conceptually? How do we lay it down? How do we do things different? And there was this huge debate, and then he takes it to the big debate back in those days was it LD, which is line of departure, or LOD, line of departure. But we were into heady shit. I didn't want to get involved in that because it was over my head. Honestly, I mean, he's just hilarious. And this goes on the whole fucking night.
I'm back in the assembly area, got my shit together, got my squad, moved up.
So listen, there's guys laughing and pounding the table like it's some comedy club.
Right behind the line of departure's little sign, he said, attack position. I said, I don't have to occupy this. I know that. But it is the last cover to conceal position. Just in case somebody's got to take a dump before we go. I got you. I got to cross this thing before. Regardless of what Cole says, you always pick a wedge. They can't screw with you if you're in a wedge. You know? Because, you know, unknown middle-around security, unknown enemy situation, I mean, who's going to argue with the wedge? Get into this echelon right shit, echelon left, too hard to control, nobody understands it, 1791 drill manual, I don't want to touch that at all. We go over the line of departure now, and we're in the open, and the little target's up on the hill, and as we're moving down, the demo pits go. Boom, boom, boom. Aha, incoming, you know. Move through incoming. We go charging through incoming. Then, tat-tat-tat-tat, you know, butter-butter-jam, butter-butter-jam. Put a little signal out here, checking at you. Aha, incoming mixed with direct fire. Down. Boom. Now, team one, prepare to rush, rush. Team two, prepare to rush, rush. Team three, and we do this up to the final coordination line. Another heady discussion. Final CL or SCL. Big discussion about all that. But, convenient, they told me that 75 to 150 meters from the objective, there would be a final coordination line. Figured in shit, it was there. Another berm on a golf course. And I got my guys up online, make sure everybody's got a fresh magazine. All this. Now, we got this far by team rushes and crawling. But that ain't good enough for these guys. They know it's time to stand up. And this made perfect sense to me. So we all stood up. My job was to keep them all on. And another heady discussion, pointing method or hit. I'm one of those guys that say, this is type orders, free spirit, hit or pointing method, whatever you want. We assault over the hill, and then we pursue by fire, and the gunny comes up, we get our tail, it's all done, they evaluate it, it was great. I'm ready for Vietnam. First firefight in Vietnam, I was in the vegetation this thick. And some bastard goes, bang! I can see one of my Marines here, one of my Marines there, nobody else. Where the hell's the lone pine tree, the assembly area, the little red sign, and ain't there? But I was a little pissed. I was pissed about a couple other things, too. No one told me about 20-meter contour lines over there. We were doing 20 feet over here. But when I got back, I got to somebody in authority, some captain, and I said, what the hell's the story? You don't understand, Lieutenant. Advanced school didn't just teach you the basics. You have to have a foundation. That was just the foundation. Those are the basics. You have to go through that first. And well, I don't mind that, but why do I have to do my graduate work in Vietnam? I mean, this should be something that kind of gets me into jungle fighting, you know, in the real way.
When he says jungle fighting, when he says the first firefight I'm in, I can see this far away. And with that, he puts his hands over his face. And when he says jungle fighting, he does it again. He puts his hand like right over his face. And that's what he's referring to.
24 years later, I'm still looking for the final coordination line, the line of departure, the phases of the offense, and all that other shit. It ain't there. You see, the problem is, what we got to do is look at reality, distill it down to a theory about war, and then learn how to apply it. You know, in here is going to be the doctrine and all the stuff we're trying to write. Here's the training and the application. You know, now I'm in here, which is great. This is easy, guys. Being back here is easy. Down here is hard. You know, I was one of these guys who taught here and at Command and Staff College. I got 10.5 years at Quantico being part of the problem. And we put out shit that doesn't work down here, you know? It doesn't work. You want to hear the shit my lieutenants tell me. I'm out here and I'm watching the suit. I said, what the hell are you doing, Lieutenant? Sir, this is the Australian peel that I was taught to take.
No shit. The Australian peel. If memory calls me right, it's some Australian way of setting up an ambush.
The Australian peel? That sounds like some sort of strip show with kids, you know? My guy told me, so you get so focused in on this little shit. We can't even give, I want to back up the first sergeant here. We can't give a challenge and password anymore. We had a good system for a challenge and password. Halt, who goes there? Sergeant Finney with a friendly patrol. Advance and be recognized. You are Sergeant Finney or you're not. You know, boss, hey, pass, you know. It was simple. Now, they're all James Bond. You know? The moon is blue, you know. How are you? We've even fucked up the techniques now. You know, we put the theory right, even the techniques are screwed up. And this is what my guys get here come out here trying to deal with. That's why we have battlefield skills on Wednesday night. You've got to watch everything they learn in Chronicle out before you can start on this stuff. You know, I read something pretty interesting, and I think it was Montgomery. It was either Montgomery or General Hackett that said, the common phrase heard amongst officers after World War I in the British Army was, thank God the war is over, we get back to real soldiers. Now that reminded me of the Marine Corps. Thank God the war is over, we get back to real soldiers. The way we do it at Quantico, you know. It's not reality. It doesn't reflect reality. I drew up a little chart here of the difference between what I saw in practice and what I learned and what I think reality is. This place taught me, and all the exercise I was ever on, the battlefield is linear. We have lines all over the place. In practice, I would believe, if I were at marching, that war is linear. You know, we have coordinated fire lines, fire support coordination lines, you know. We have boundaries that are lines. Mike Wiley says we're in boxes all the time. That's right. You know, and we would believe that. My humble experience in Vietnam is a non-linear battlefield. The VC did everything in depth. If you had to characterize the VC by a formation, you'd probably get guys that always said, we're always getting caught horseshoe ambushes. See, they looked at things in some kind of depth to deliver fire from two sides. And then the little bastards would connect these suckers like this. You'd run into a bunker complex on the reverse slope in the middle of the jungle that was a series of these kinds of things. So when you went to hit it, you got nailed. You went to envelop it, like they taught me in the basic school, you got tricked screwed again. You know, you went to do a masterful turning movement and come in, after got you again. I mean, you couldn't get this little guy.
Yeah, so what he draws is just a formation, not a formation, but a position that's literally a two X's, well, an X, right? So, and it's a trench line. So you, but whatever point you bump into, whatever you try to do to it, you're always going to, you're taking fire from both sides. So he draws it up there, and he continues to talk about it here.
Get your hands around. He didn't offer me all that plank shit and everything else, and I couldn't take him on front of it. This guy had steps. He had too many sides. He had too many facets to his formation. We were slick. We're in boxes and lines all the time. That doesn't work. This works. I was always taught frontal inclination, basically. You take them on head on, or conveniently, he'll have an unanchored flight that just dangles off the side of the hill. I got to be clean for a day a second time. I got to envelop at range 5. The thing that scared the shit out of me is the hill was huge.
It's range 11, actually. Right, it's when he was talking about another attack, it's a platoon attack and it's an envelopment, and so you have I want to say two squads that attack this frontally, so they're doing fire movement up to a berm, and then you get to that berm, you lay in there, and then you suppress the target, and another squad, so two squads do that. You have machine guns firing from behind you. Not over your head, but it seems like over your head. They're firing adjacent to you on the target to suppress it while the two platoons close with the enemy, right? So you got machine guns firing. It's pretty awesome the first time you do it. And then what you have is you have a third squad that runs, that gets on this trail, and you run parallel to the attack, but it's down in a creek, so you're physically protected in case somebody cuts around in your direction, right? So you're down there, and you got the AIs with you, and then you get to the base of this hill that you got to go up, and I swear to God, it's a 45-degree angle, and they used to have somebody throw a smoke, and he'll talk about throwing a Willie Peter grenade, which sets fire to shit, but you gotta throw the shit out of it, man. It's not like you toss it. You have to fire it up the hill and get it out into the open. And that's the signal to shift the base of fire. Okay, so the machine guns, then you're attacking from left to right. They were moving back to front, and you ran around the left hand side, and so everybody's suppressing the enemy. You're going to now attack him from the flank. You throw the smoke, and they shift to the right portion of the target. All right. So for those of you that have never seen it, and then on a second signal, they'll cease. Okay, so you're down there, and I was part of the enveloping squad. Well, when I was a student, and then I did it again as an instructor all the time, and it's you know, I'll tell you what, I mean, doing that with people that are doing it for the first time, always interesting.
In those days, when men were men, we threw a Willie Peter grenade as a signal to cease or shift the base of fire. Now, there's a smoke stick. And I got after that Willie Peter grenade, and I looked up that hill. The rest of the guys in my squad were like this. And the guy, the skipper, was the guy who ran squad tactics with this. Big guy from the south, you know, one of those guys, 287, he loads at the back there. He says, Cindy, you an Alice arm? This would be the greatest role of my life. So all that sucker up there. But the envelopment was the same. I mean, conveniently, all the targets were facing that way when the top of the hill. This is great. You know, all the enemy will give us a flank. They don't. Infiltration and penetration is the way you got to go. We beat that to death. I know we've talked about that a lot. In practice, we seize terrain. We do what I call process terrain. We process ridge lines. We process high ground. We go from one piece of high ground to another piece. I was an instructor command of staff college. We gave graded requirements there. Some of you were students at that time. Now you run the institution. They better than everybody else. But we would say, give us a concept, you know, along with the overlay and everything else. I get these things back. They were great. The symbology was perfect. Everything was indented correctly. All the words were there. But it didn't say anything. They processed terrain. Objective 1, objective 2, objective alpha, objective bravo. Intermediate objective, because a little smaller piece of high ground is a bump between this ridge line and that ridge line. So it is a goddamn intermediate objective, you know? We process this terrain all the time. We over-focus on terrain all the time. As I said today, in the 9th Marine Regiment 2 years, I never ever designated a terrain objective. There was nothing that ever had RLT objective 1 or objective out 1. Never. I never ever designated terrain objective. It misfocuses. It's needless. You don't need it. Terrain's overrated. When I say key terrain, first thing comes to your mind is high ground. I contend high ground is not key terrain. Low ground is key terrain.
Now, this is Vietnam experience talking. I don't know if it was him that taught me, but somebody taught me, use the word vicinity when you refer to the enemy. Because if you don't, they're going to put a point on their map. But if you say the enemy's last spotted or spotted in the vicinity of digging, they know that they've got to go develop that disposition as opposed to, oh, no, he's here. He said, and then he all these small things that communicate the reality of the battlefield as opposed to the way we used to do it. And his whole processing of terrain thing, that's the way we used to do it. Circles on mountains and go from one to the next. But you read the experience of Vietnam, where were the bad guys? Where was the NBA? They were in the low ground, right? They were transiting on the side of hills. They weren't on top of hills. We were on top of the hills shooting artillery. They were in other places.
The time to occupy high ground is to control low ground. Really a low ground, the avenues of approach, the kinds of places you move through are less important. Everything else really gears you to that. You know, it's what gives you the freedom to move, and usually it's down there. Some interesting thoughts. I got a class on terrain and everything else and on movement. Interesting to study the VC and how they moved and why we couldn't find it. Because I read a few books written by some people, and I talked to some VC NBA prisoners when I was a stupid ass lieutenant captain to figure out why can't we ever find these little suckers. And he told me why, a couple of them. You know, it's the way they move. Ingenious, not the way we think about moving. I think really, instead of seizing terrain, you got to look at how that enemy's deployed, where he is, where the force is, how he's disposed. And you got to develop that disposition. That is going to be what you're going to do to unravel them rather than seize terrain. I was taught about deliberate attacks. I just described one. You know, the line of departure, the final coordination line, everything else. It's a series of meeting engagements most of the times out there. The guy never conveniently clocks himself on top of the hill with one pine tree waiting for me to attack him. He just bumps into me and hits me when I'm not expecting him from the wrong direction. All the time he does that. He doesn't cooperate. He isn't part of school's demonstration troops, like I learned when I was a lieutenant. SDT used to be the forerunner of the old EI company or support panel, whatever the hell you call it now. Those guys played the game right. Bad guys don't. I learned about a deliberate defense. Once you stop, you change everything. On the military crest of a hill, you set in a defense. If you were in a zone, forget that. Now you're in a sector of the defense. You're not in a zone of attack anymore. It's because you stopped. You know, now we have FPLs, PDFs, you know, vinyl protective fires. We're going to put out tactical supplementary protective wire. We're going to do all this shit, do all that. You know, we're going to put this tremendous defense in. The Maginot Line going in overnight. Never, ever in my life did I do that. I have always in my life put in a hasty defense. I stopped for a short period of time and had to get a hasty defense. I didn't change the names of things. I didn't have time to go through this tremendous preparation. You know, it just wasn't there. I'll tell you what, I used to look and sit on the front end of this thing and say, why am I here instead of there?
He's talking about the front end of a terrain feature, and he talked about the reverse slope defense.
Where somebody, and I read Mike Wiley's article in the Gazette on the reverse slope defense and found out, I'd be smarter if I was back there instead of up front here. You know, and that's where we're going to have to look at putting in these defenses. This is planning-oriented. This is execution-oriented. The way we talk about and practice it is process-oriented. The process is the end unto itself. We beat that to death. This one's personality-oriented.
All right. We're going to take a break. Those are the two parts. That's part one of this whole thing. You'll hear the rest of it next week. If you want to hear it right now, you can listen to it. But what I would tell you is if you're on active duty, you can go to our website and you can find the videos. You can find the audio. People should listen to it, and they should listen to it because if you're a company commander, I did this with my company, right? This is how I see it. And, you know, and I ripped off a lot of shit from him, right? This is how I see it. This is what we're going to be. This is how I expect you to do it. And from company to, again, platoon, squad, I mean, everybody ought to have a pitch, their own version of combat concepts. And you know what? We just don't do it. We don't do it. And that's not a good thing. All right, we're going to take a quick break. The gunner going to join us. We're going to hear Mike Musselman on the march. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.